our own Suzanne N. from Santa Maria.
I almost got him. Damn. I'm Suzanne. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Glenn for asking me to speak. It's always an honor and a privilege to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially in this room. This is where I got sober. I never know what I'm going to say, so I'll apologize in advance for anything that offends any of you, because, you know, you just never know what's going to come out of my mouth. So, yeah. If you have a problem with anything I say up here, talk to your sponsor about it, because, you know, because I might change my mind about it by the time I leave this meeting. So, it's just my experience, strength, and hope. I talk about drugs. I talk about things that you're not supposed to talk about in AA. My first sponsor told me, Suzanne, you can talk about anything you want in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. So I do. That's just kind of how I was raised here. She also told me that you might get some negative feedback after the meeting on what you shared, so be prepared for that. I came into this room in March of 1989, and I had had a DUI. And I was 22 years old, and my drinking was getting scary, but I didn't really want to be here. I came to this this meeting, and I didn't know anything about AA, but I had a court card that I needed to get signed. I had six meetings that I needed to go to, and they just seemed like, God, six meetings, I don't want to go there. And I came to this meeting, and there was they did birthdays, and some guy got up and he took a cake for 6 years. And I didn't know anything about AA. The first thing I did when I walked in the room was I looked around. I wanted to figure out where the front of the room was so that I could sit in the back. So I sat right back there where Stan's at with my mom, who drugged me here because I kept telling her for months that I was going to AA meetings, and I always came home drunk, and she didn't believe me. So she decided she was going to come to the meeting and get sober, too. And I thought, oh, good. I'm going to come to AA with my mommy. So we came to the meeting, and the guy got up and he took a cake for 6 years, and he said, I'm Dan, I'm an alcoholic, and I haven't had a drink in 6 years. And I thought, oh my God, these people don't drink it. Oh, why are we here? And then the speaker got up, and that's all he talked about was drinking, and I thought, well, how's anybody supposed to stay sober if that's all you're talking about? I mean, for the love of God, I'm trying to, you know, not drink, and you're talking about alcohol, and that meeting just made me thirsty. So I told my mom, yeah, I'll meet you at home. I got to stop by the store on the way home, and, you know, really, I mean, we all know what happened then, right? I mean, I had some drinking to do. And that weekend I went to a bar. I went to O'Sullivan's Pub. It was one of the places that I hadn't been kicked out of yet, and it was St. Patrick's Day, so you gotta drink on St. Patrick's Day, right? I mean, I could be Irish, right? Who knows? And that was about the end of my drinking, because on that day I got arrested again. I woke up in jail. I had threatened a barmaid with a knife. After I got out of jail, it just got uglier, and it just kept getting uglier. I started drinking when I was 12. My mother was an alcoholic, and and I grew up in a home where I never knew what was going to happen next. You know, my parents were divorced, and I lived with my mom, and she was really successful, and but she worked all the time, and I was kind of raised by housekeepers, which was a good thing. My mom was a neat lady. She really was. But every night after 5, she would start drinking, and it's kind of scary when you're little to be raised by an alcoholic because you don't know what's going to happen, and there isn't a sense of security. And I was one of those kids that I was really shy. I was afraid of a lot of things. And so by the time I was about 12 years old, all those feelings that I had to go somewhere, and that's where I found alcohol and drugs. I was raised in Christian schools, and my mother sent me to Christian schools. We weren't religious at all. Neither one of my parents were. My brother was a Buddhist. I've got cousins that are Hare Krishnas. I mean, you know, it got really confusing. So they sent me to a Lutheran school, and then they sent me to a Baptist school, and then she was going to send me to a Catholic high school, and it was like, for the love of God, woman, you never even go to church. I mean, why are you sending me to all these places? Made me wear a dress and be nice to people and told me I was going to hell, and, you know, it was too much. So in about, I don't know, seventh grade, I started drinking, and, you know, it's interesting being the only alcoholic seventh grader in the Christian school, but my birthday parties were really fun, you know, until everybody's mom found out. You know, I would spike the punch at my birthday parties and invite all the little Christian girls over who, you know, and pretty soon, nobody wanted to come over anymore. I couldn't figure it out. You know, you hear it from the podium a lot. I always felt different, and I did. Growing up kind of in that sheltered environment, I'd go over to my friend's house, and they had two parents, and they would sit down to eat dinner, and nobody was drunk, and they would do things together, and it was odd. It was just kind of odd. You know, and I would go home, and my life looked great. I mean, I lived upper middle class. We lived at the beach. You know, like I said, my mom was really successful. So on the outside, it didn't really make sense to me. You know, everything looked good on the outside, and we were really apparently concerned about what it looked like on the outside. I wasn't abused. I wasn't neglected. I had all my needs met. It was just, you know, I was alone most of the time. So by the time I was 12, I started drinking, and my first drunk was, she always had a fully stocked bar, which was great for me and my friends, you know. I poured a tumbler full of vodka, about that much, and I think I was, I was about in seventh grade, and I chased it with, I think some like flat Dr. Pepper or something. It was actually quite gross. But I drank that whole thing of vodka, and we lived in this two-story house at the beach, and I decided at some point, I guess, to put on roller skates. I don't know. I blacked out at some point, but I was upstairs, and I don't remember a lot of it, but when I woke up in the morning, I was in a bathtub fully clothed in cold water with one roller skate on, slung outside the bathtub with the meanest hangover you've ever had in your life, with my mother banging on the door telling me I was late for school. And I thought, and she kept saying, what happened to the plant at the bottom of the stairs? She had this really nice plant. It was thrashed. It was all over the house. And I mean, I didn't remember anything. So that was my first drunk, and I told myself, you know what, I'm never going to do that again. You know, that was awful. And you know how we are. It's like, I just got to learn to control and enjoy it. So I did. The thing that I liked about alcohol is it took me, it's like I found God. It was everything I needed it to be. It made all the feelings go away. I wasn't stressed out anymore. I didn't care what my mother was doing anymore. I didn't care about any of that. And I liked the effect produced by alcohol, like it says in the book. I wanted to check out. I didn't want to be me anymore. I didn't want to be in my situation anymore. You know, and at that point, I mean, and I look back and I think it's kind of pathetic when like a 13-year-old girl is at the liquor store getting people to spot me beer. You know, really, I would get like guys, and you always get guys, you know, guys, they'll do anything. Here's $5, you know, here's $5, buy me beer, and they would, and it was like, cool, that's so cool. And I mean, I would go party with people I didn't know. I just run into people and it'd be like, hey, want to go smoke out? Oh, yeah, sure, let's do that. You know, I ended up in some of the scariest ass places with the trippiest people. And, you know, when I think about it, it's like, at the time it was fun. I had fun. I used to hitchhike down to L.A. I lived in Ventura. And I would hitchhike down to L.A. and go see concerts. You know, back in the day, that was what you did, you know. And you could still hitchhike back in the 80s. I mean, that wasn't, you know, nobody was really doing it but me and my girlfriends. But, you know, people would pick us up and give us rides. You know, I wonder how many serial killers we actually got away from at this point. You know, I seriously think about that because there were some really sketchy situations. So we'd go down to LA and we'd go see The Who, or I'd buy tickets to concerts and didn't know how we were going to get there. So we'd just go and we'd hitchhike down to LA and go. And that was fun. That was a lot of fun at the time. Looking back, I'm frightened as hell for myself. You know, I really, I've raised a teenage daughter, so I know how scary that is. I started hanging out. I thought, you know, who am I going to hang out with that parties like I do? And I was hanging out with surfers because I lived at the beach, and they were kind of lame. All they wanted to do was surf all day, and they didn't drink like I did. And so I thought, yeah, I'm just going to go to the top of the party food chain and hang out with bikers. And so I did. And at 15, I could get into any bar I wanted to as long as I was with these guys. You know, nobody's going to card you when you're with a bunch of bikers. So at 15, I was hitting bars and partying with bikers and going to bike runs and doing all of that. And I got kind of hardened after a while. Drinking and partying the way I did kind of does that to you. It kind of toughens you up really quick. So I got pretty mean, I think. But on one of my hitchhiking adventures, we had crashed the party and we were hitchhiking back, and this van picked us up, which wasn't unusual. Everybody had a van back then. You know, that was right after the 70s when everybody had the van with the bed in the back, you know. I mean, you guys are missing it now with the Prius and all the lame shit they got going on. But really, we had the, you know, with the shag carpet and all the cool shit in it, right? Look at Virgie over there. Yeah, I remember. You got a van, huh, Virgie? So yeah, it was a great place to party, but I met the love of my life, and he had a bike and he had a job, you know, and he was over 21 and he could buy, and at 15, you know, I had a 24-year-old boyfriend, and as long as you could buy alcohol and you had money, I really didn't have a lot of standards, but that whole, you know, having a bike and being a biker, that was cool too. So by the time I was 18, I was pregnant with my daughter, and we were going to live happily ever after. And we got our own little studio apartment, and I thought, yeah, and here comes the white picket fence and all the stuff. And the thing I forgot is I was a raging alcoholic, and he was an IV cocaine user, and there's no picket fence. You know, there really isn't. And and I had my daughter, and right after I had my daughter, her dad got sick from using drugs. And for the next 2 years, we went through hospitals and institutions and finally death. He died right before her third birthday from drug use. And that was when my drinking really took off. I decided, you know what, fuck this. I said, fuck this, right into this little recorder thing. Okay? Fuck this. God, is Lee here? I hope not. In the meantime, I had moved up here with my daughter because that relationship was dragging me down, and those people were the reason that I was drinking all the time. And if I just could move away, I would be okay. So I moved up here, and I didn't know anybody in Santa Maria. My dad lived in San Luis, but I moved to a place where I had no clue, you know. So my mom moved me up here to get me out of her house because all I did was lay on the couch after work and drink beer all the time and ignore my daughter. I got to tell you at this point, you know what, I was a hideous mom. I never beat my child. I never did any of that, but I was such an alcoholic. It wasn't about her. It was all about me. The selfishness that went into my addiction was incredible looking back on that. And I'm not one of those people that has a natural mom instinct. So on that coupled with the alcohol, really, I thought it was like a pet, you know? I mean, seriously. When I found out I was pregnant, you know, my mom always asked me, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? You're not just going to lay around here and drink beer. So when I found out I was pregnant, I'm like, well, this is what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. I mean, it's a baby, right? How hard can it be? You know, I mean, shit, it's like a pet, right? You just feed it and play with it every now and then. And how hard can that be? Women have been doing this for years. Well, for the love of God. So we moved up here, and right shortly after we moved up here, I moved up here in 87. Her dad died. I got evicted from my house. I hooked up with a cocaine dealer that I met at a bar. And let's see, what else happened? I got a DUI. I got a DUI in October of 1988. I was coming down the Canal Grade from Thousand Oaks, and I had been drinking for 12 hours, and I was weaving all over the place. And I got pulled over by a bunch of, I called them Jesus freaks, because the minute I got to the bottom of the grade, I was on the grade, and I remember this part. I was in a blackout, but they were flashing their lights and honking their horns, and they were behind me, and I'm thinking, oh my God, weirdos are coming to get me. So I pulled over in Camarillo, and I got out of the car, and I tried to run, and they took my keys, and it just got really weird, and I walked back to the car, and the cops were there, and they had me walk up the hill in boots and do the alphabet backwards, and it was like, I can't do that sober. What's the matter with you? And I knew I'd been drinking for a really long time, so I stalled them. They said, you want a blood, breath, or urine? And I said, take my blood, because I knew they had to take me to the hospital. And I knew it would take maybe an hour, and my blood alcohol would go down. And turns out my blood alcohol after like 2 hours was still at 0.28. I had built a real tolerance to drinking. You know, you drink for 10 years daily, and that happens. I was a blackout, pass-out, throw-up alcoholic, you know, bed spins, I mean, you name it. My life started going downhill when I moved to San Maria, because I was doing the same stuff in bars here that I did with people where I knew people, you know. People had my back down there, and I moved up here with nobody, and I would go to bars. I was thrown out of what's Louis B's now. It used to be the Silver Dollar. I was thrown out of there twice in the same night because I was in a blackout the first time, and I didn't remember them kicking me out. So I went over to O'Sullivan's, and I walked back to the Silver Dollar, and I started my shit again, and they said, we just kicked you out of here. I said, no, you didn't. I would have remembered that. Well, blackout drinkers don't remember a lot, so I had gotten to the point, you know, when I gave birth to my daughter, I gave birth to a conscience, and it was killing me that I was going out every night and doing dangerous stuff, you know, and I would wake up in the morning, and I would just want to die, because one more time I did that thing I said I wasn't going to do, you know. I hooked up with that person that I didn't even know who they were. I woke up in places that it was like, where the hell am I, you know? I mean, I used to wake up in places that it'd be like, I'm laying on a couch and I hear people talking Chinese, and I'm like, what the fuck? You know, I mean, I woke up in some weird places. I woke up in Big Sur one time. I didn't know how I got there, you know, but I wake up on a couch and people are talking Chinese, and I look around, and there's like the Chinese grandma, and then there's the kids, and then the mom and dad, and I'm thinking, well, how do you get out of this one, you know? I thought maybe I was in China. I wasn't sure, you know. Turns out me and my friend went home with this guy, and I don't know, I guess I passed out on the couch, and he lived with his mom and grandma and everybody else. But, you know, that's one of those huh moments. I met some people from Lompoc when I moved here, and this is an example of how I drank. I was really drunk, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, I decided I wanted to go get some meth, which meth wasn't my thing. But, you know, it all sounds good when you're drinking. So I went Harris Grade, and I was driving. I put my daughter in her car seat. You know, we've got to be safe here. And I drove Harris Grade with no lights on, and I went over to a friend's house. That's the kind of stuff I used to do. You know, I'd be driving drunk all the time with my kid in the car. but the one thing, this is the end of my drinking, but this is kind of typical of what I would do. I went to a bachelorette party in Lompoc, and I never tell the story. For the love of God, I don't know why I'm telling it now. And I remember getting really drunk at the bar and her telling me, come and sleep on my in-law's couch. You know, she was living with her in-laws, these elderly people. And I said, okay, so sleeping on the couch. And I remember she kept coming in and telling me, you just gotta go to bed. And I'm like, okay, I don't know what I was doing, right? And earlier that night, I was over at that house, and I said, well, I gotta use your bathroom. And she says, well, it's down the hall and to the right. And I went down the hall, and it was straight down the hall. I said, oh, okay. Well, I remembered that later that night, apparently, when I was in a blackout and I had to pee, so I went down the hall to the right, walked in the door, lifted up what I thought was the toilet seat, sat down and peed. And what I had ended up really doing is I went into the in-laws' bedroom, opened up the door, lifted up the box springs, pulled my pants down, sat on the box springs, peed on the floor. Well, these two elderly people were awake in bed, screaming. And this is typical of my whole mindset at the time. Is I remember sitting there and hearing all this screaming, and I turned around, and all I could say was, what is your problem? You know, that was my whole life, is what is your problem? I didn't care what behavior I did, what I said to you, how I made you feel, what is your problem? It was always your fault, your problem. Yeah, so I didn't remember this. I had to be told this story, and it slowly came back to me, because when I woke up in the morning, I kind of vaguely remembered something, like when you remember, oh shit, I did something, but I don't remember what it was, but I gotta go. And that happened all the time, but it got to the point where it wasn't funny anymore. It was just humiliating, you know. So when I came in after that weekend at O'Sullivan's Pub and I walked in this door, I understood what they meant when they said demoralization. I got that. I lived that, you know. I sat in an 11 o'clock Sunday meeting, and I don't know, because that one meeting that I went to with that speaker talking about drinking, I had taken the meeting schedule and I had thrown it in the junk drawer because I figured that's where that's going. I ain't going back there. But that night, that morning when I woke up and I had threatened the barmaid and gotten out of jail and hitchhiked and done all this stuff, I sat on my living room floor and I said, God help me, because I wanted to kill myself. And I had never said, God help me for anything. I wasn't one of those, God get me out of this people. I had long ago thought, fuck God, really. You know, and if that isn't the most blasphemous thing I've ever said from the podium. But that was how I felt, and I said, God help me. And for some reason, I got off the floor, and I went to that junk drawer, and I found that meeting schedule, and I showed up to a meeting. And I listened to what you had to say. I heard that things like, I have a hole in my gut that you could drive a truck through. I knew what that meant. I could relate to the feelings. I knew that you knew how I felt. And the more I listened, the more I thought, these people are inside my head. What is this? You know, they're talking about stuff that I get. And then I thought, God, how embarrassing. These people are sharing this shit, their personal business. God, you know, I went back and forth between, wow, these people are really cool, and wow, these people are lame. I'm embarrassed for you. You know, it's that I'm better than you. I'm less than you. You know, we do that. And I heard the newcomer's the most important person in the room, and I thought, right on. I didn't raise my hand or anything. I wasn't gonna like put myself out there on front street. And after the meeting was over, you know, I figured people would come up and talk to me because I was the most important person in the room. I mean, that's what you said, right? And everybody laughed. And I sat out on that bench so hungover and so hurting. I was so desperate. Somebody came up here and said it. I was so desperate. That I sat out on that bench, and this old guy came up to me. His name was Monty, and he saved my life. That man saved my life. He said, he asked me a bunch of questions, and he told me, he says, I want to see you here at the 7 o'clock speaker meeting tonight. And I thought, okay. And he says, do you think you can stay sober until then? And it was noon, and I said, I don't know, Monty. And he said, you try and stay sober until 7 o'clock. And I said, I'll try. I showed up to that meeting, and the lady that spoke, had sat across from me at that 11 o'clock meeting, and she seemed so nice, and she had this little nice accent, and she was just so sweet, and I thought, God, what the fuck's the matter with you? What'd you call it? Did you fall off a bar stool at the PTA meeting and end up at Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, you couldn't have drank like I drank. And she got up and she told the story about being a heroin addict and a prostitute. And so she volunteered to be my sponsor after that meeting. And, you know, I had gotten so hard and I had gotten so antisocial that it was weird to sit in meetings and have people be nice to me. It was weird to have people come up to me and, like, touch me on the shoulder without doing this. It was weird to have people hug me. She had hugged me after this meeting, and I remember standing there. She comes up and she hugs me, and I'm thinking, okay, how do we do this? You know, it was like, I think I stood there like this and just was like, this is odd, you know, and some of your rituals and the whole holding hands and praying, what are you, a bunch of, you know, homos, ain't you? You know. You know, and I didn't know what the Serenity Prayer was, and I wasn't sure what you guys were talking about half the time, and some of the stuff didn't make sense, and you know, you were all too nice, and I was sure half you were on pills, and, you know, I was just busy judging you, and then, you know, I was so out there. She bought me a book, and I started reading it, and about 2 weeks sober, I stayed sober for 2 weeks, and about 2 weeks sober, I got bored, and I thought, you know, because sobriety's boring when you're 22 and there's no young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there certainly wasn't any bikers here at that point. So she had told me, you know what, Suzanne, you can pray for anything you want. So I prayed for excitement, and I got it. And I had, it was right after Easter, and I'd stayed sober 13 days. No, yeah, and it was April Fool's Day, and I prayed for excitement, and all of a sudden I hear this Harley roar up in my driveway, and it was like, oh, cool. So this guy that I'd met at a bar that I didn't remember meeting at a bar, who apparently knew where I lived, wanted to go for a ride. I said, sure, you know, and. We went back to his house, and he says, hey, you want a beer? And I said, no, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober 2 whole weeks, and I started telling him about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, you want to split one? I said, sure. Because there's a difference. And that's when I realized what cunning, baffling, powerful means. You know, and the same thing happened that night and that morning that had happened every other night and morning previous to that. I ended up going 80 miles an hour down Broadway with him in the car. This is this tough biker guy who is screaming like a girl. Stop the car. You know, I don't know, you know. One more time, the demoralization. You know, and that relapse actually led me into, my last drunk was actually here in this room, and I sat right where Henry's at, back there on the wall, and I was drunk, and I was in a floppy hat, and I didn't have any shoes on, and I had my daughter with me, who was 3, and I remember sitting back there, and I talked through the whole meeting, and I kept whispering to people and shit. You know how we whisper when we're drinking? It's like, hey, hey, hey. I don't know what it was. It was like I would go deaf when I'd start drinking. You ever do that? You start talking like this. Yeah. I swear to God, I'd go deaf. So yeah, I remember sitting back there and I said, you know what, I don't have a drinking problem, I have a sobriety problem. I thought that was so profound. I thought, well, I'm a poet and shit. So April 6th was the first day that I stayed sober, and you know, I had that sponsor, Mary, and she walked me through some shit, boy. She walked me through feelings. I didn't know that I wanted to stay sober, and I knew I didn't want to drink anymore, and it was a hard place to be. You know, I didn't know what you people had, but I knew what was out there, and they would tell me, you know what, Suzanne, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And I thought, wow, that is so profound. And then I went, no, it isn't. It was like, it took me about 6 to get a good buzz going on. And then, you know, and they're like, no, you don't get it. If you don't take the first drink, you don't get drunk. And that was like the, oh, wow. And I had a sponsor who gave me her number, and she told me, you call me at any time, you can call me at 2 o'clock in the morning. So I did, just to see if she would answer. I mean, I was up, you know, because I couldn't sleep. It was like, let's see if she picks up the phone. I called her all the time, and I was just one of those newcomers that was just, I was angry all the time. You know, and I didn't believe in God, and yeah, I can do the first step, but I'm not going to do the ones with God in them. I don't want to hear about God. God's never done anything for me. You don't understand. She'd say, ask God to keep you sober every morning, Suzanne. And I'd say, you're not hearing me. I don't believe in God. And she said, I don't give a shit what you believe in. Just do it anyway. It still works. And I would do it, and I would stay sober. And they would tell me stuff like, don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle happens. And I kept going. You know, I had like 90 days sober. And I said, so when is this miracle going to happen? And she goes, "You been, how long have you been sober?" I said, like 90 days. She goes, that's the miracle. I couldn't stay sober for a week. My 30-day trip was huge. The fact that I stayed sober 2 weeks was incredible. I mean, I drank and used every day. I had to hang on to my ass to stay here, and it was not easy. You know, my first year was the hardest, you know, and I love seeing people get there 1 year. I really do. It's the best. I tried to sabotage myself all the way to a year. I remember having 9 months, and I would do things like, okay, God. Because at this point I believed in God, because I would pray and all these weird things would happen. I'd want to drink. I remember I'd go and I'd say, fuck this, I didn't get sober to feel like this, this is bullshit. And I'd go and buy a 12-pack and I'd come home and I'd put it on the counter and I'd, you know, have my beer out and I had it cracked and I'm like, I'm just going to drink. And then I would remember. My sponsor told me the shortest prayer you could ever say is, God help me. And when you get your ass in a crack, God help me. Say God help me and see what happens, and I did. And the minute I said God help me, my sponsor called, and I'm like, oh my God, that's creepy. And by the time I got off the phone, I didn't want to drink. And then another time, I went and bought another 12-pack. I'm like, fuck this, I ain't doing this anymore. This is hard. I don't want to feel like this. And I had the 12-pack there, and I fell asleep. And by the time I woke up, I didn't want to drink. And I had to pick my daughter up from school. I haven't done this program perfect. I haven't at all. I've done things in recovery that I'm not ashamed of, but had I thought about it, I probably would have made different choices. The one thing that I've done is I haven't picked up, no matter what, you know? It's like, I don't drink, I don't use, I don't smoke spice, I don't drink near beer, I don't snort near cocaine, I don't shoot near heroin, you know? I just don't, because I don't want to piss all over the gift, you know what I mean? This has been a gift to me, to be able to stay here, because I was 22 when I got here. I was probably one of the youngest people in this room. There wasn't a lot of young people, and I had old-timers, you know, that were taking bets that I wouldn't stay. Oh, well, she'll go out. She's too angry. They would tell me shit, like, on a Wednesday, hey, Suzanne, yeah, Joe Blow's having this, you know, birthday for his 20-year, you know, cake, and it's going to be over at Orchid Hill this Saturday. You want to go? It'd be like, yeah, I'll go. And they said, well, if you can stay sober that long. They would tell me shit like that. It was like, no, you don't understand. I'm really fucking angry here. I'm going to stay sober. I'd be all pissed. I stayed sober on resentments for a long time, for about the first year. I would pick up the phone. My first sponsor, she had 6 years and she drank when I had 4 months of sobriety. I had another sponsor who, she had 6 or 8 years, and apparently she was on pills. I had no clue. Everybody else knew but me, and then she showed up to this meeting and would do shit like she would call the club and say, yeah, I got a gun, and I'm going to shoot up this meeting. She started drinking again and lost her mind. Had to keep calling the cops on her. She was interesting. You know, and then I had Pam for a sponsor, and Pam was awesome. She would tell me stuff like, you know what, feelings aren't facts, Suzanne. You take the action and the feelings follow. That's how it works. She was real cut and dried with me. You know, I had people in here that loved me enough to hurt my feelings. If you got people in your life telling you shit you don't want to hear that's good for you, those are the people you keep around. They really are. You know, and I've seen a lot of people love to death in this program, just coddled as hell. Back when I got sober, they didn't really coddle you. It was like, you want this or not, you know. If you don't, go drink. You're over 21. My first sponsor got tired of me whining at her on the phone because I would call her up and go, I want to drink so bad, and she'd go, well, I'll get your daughter and come over and we'll have coffee and talk about it. So I got used to that, and then one day I called her and I said that, and she goes, come over and bring your daughter. So I came over and brought my daughter. She goes, I'm going to watch your daughter. You can either go to a meeting or you can go drink. I don't give a shit. You're going to have to figure out that this is your recovery, your sobriety, and you're going to have to own it. And that was the turning point from me whining and thinking I was going to stay sober for everybody else but me. That was when I started staying sober for me. I've been in this program long enough that I've walked through a lot of stuff, and there's different parts. Like my first year, the night that I got my 1 year chip was my actual 1 year, and I had tried to sabotage that all the way up to a year. About 9 months, I thought, well, I should drink now. I don't want to blow it after I have a year. I would tell myself stuff like that. Okay, God, if you don't want me to drink, give me a sign. I mean, really, you know. And normally I would get a sign. It was creepy. But at a year, I had accomplished something, and I didn't know how to deal with it. I'd been a fuck-up my whole life. I really had. So I came in here, and it's interesting. You know, God sends you people that are actually angels. They're just in the form of people. I came in to get my chip, and I was going to leave, and I was going to go drink because I didn't deserve it. And I sat at the end of that table over there, and this lady came, and she brought me flowers for my year. And I'm not a flower-type girl. They used to call me the badass bitch from hell when I got here. And I sat there, and I said, I don't think I can do this. And she goes, you can do this. And what she did is she held onto my arm. She held it to the table so I couldn't leave. So I got through that meeting, and I got my chip, and I got up, and I rambled off something like, I shouldn't be here, and I don't know if I want this. And because in my head, I'm going to stay sober a year, and if it doesn't get any better, then I'll drink. And in reality, it did get better. You know, in that year, I had to learn how to stay sober no matter what, and you hang onto your ass, even when you want to drink, and you pick up the phone, and you talk to people, and you work those steps, you know. I've worked all those steps multiple times. You know, my first inventory was bullshit. I was a victim. It's all your fault. You know, you did this to me. They did this to me. My mother was an alcoholic. Poor fucking me. You know, I'm not an alcoholic because my mother was an alcoholic. You know, I grew up in this program, but I actually got into recovery when I started taking responsibility for my actions instead of blaming everybody else for it. You know, there's nothing worse than being the whiny asshole in the room and everybody knows it but you. And I didn't want to be that person anymore, you know, really. There's no victim, Suzanne, only volunteers. Oh, shut the fuck up. I don't want to hear that. I was a badass bitch from hell. At 6 years, I had begun to unwork the program. I actually almost had 6 years, and I had sat in these rooms long enough that everybody said, God, Suzanne, you're doing so good, and God, Suzanne, you've changed so much, and all the anger's gone. And I got to a point where I wanted to drink again because I stopped working my program and I started taking your inventory. I had unworked the steps, and that was probably the darkest period in my recovery, is going through that. The one thing that I didn't do was I didn't stop going to meetings, because I'd always heard that people who drink stop going to meetings. So I kept coming to meetings, and people will tell you, you know what, I'll just put it right out there. I mean, I think you've noticed with the fuck God statement and all of that, but I don't really care what comes out of my mouth most of the time, you know, unless I'm in a church, and God knows. But I don't mind telling you what's going on, and I was told, you know what, you suit up, you show up, you be honest, even when it makes you look bad. And I've had to do that. I've had to be that person in the room with time that said, you know what, if I stay sober a week, I'll have 6 years, and I don't care, and I want to drink, and this is painful, and I don't like this. And I've had to be that person sitting in that room saying that, and have somebody with, you know, 2 weeks sober come up and pat me on the back and go, you just keep coming back. Keep coming back. And be walked around the parking lot while I stomped and screamed and did all of that. And you know what? What it is, it got back to Suzanne, work the steps again. Suzanne, work the steps again and be honest again and peel one more layer again. You know, in April I celebrated 25 years of sobriety.
Wow.
And I don't say that for applause. It's a miracle to me. It just blows my mind because I've been given so much. You know, I walked in here with a 3-year-old daughter who was afraid of me. Because all I knew how to do was yell. I had no parenting skills at all. And I learned how to be a mom here. You know, I learned how to be a mom here. I learned how to put my child first. I learned how to provide for my daughter as a single mom. You know, when I had no skills, no nothing. I mean, we figured it out and God provided. You know, I was told food, shelter, clothing. Do the footwork, God takes care of the rest. And I had to believe that stuff. And you know what, guys? I believed it and it happened. You know, I had to turn it over to God and go, okay, God, I've done all the footwork I can do. You're going to have to do something. And then that's where God gets to work the miracle. And it's happened for me. This little girl that was afraid of me, you know, I had to raise her through teenage years. And the fact that I didn't kill her at 13 is a testament to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, one of the greatest gifts I've been given is that my daughter's not an alcoholic today. And they told me that. You know, I come from a long line of alcoholics, and she's the first one that I know of that isn't. And I'm so grateful for that. I have a lot of gratitude for a lot of the things that have happened to me in this program. Some of the best ones is, you know, she got married a couple of years ago, and she asked me to walk her down the aisle, you know. That's huge. That's huge. And had you told me that when I got here, I would have been like, big deal. I was looking for cash and prizes and strippers, you know. Big deal, you know. She wanted me there when she had my grandson, you know. She wanted me there when she had my granddaughter, you know. I've got 2 beautiful grandkids and 1 on the way, you know. That's huge. You know, she calls me when she has a problem. You know, that's big. Nobody was asking my advice about shit when I got here, I can tell you that. And they told me shit like, hey, Suzanne, you better learn to laugh at yourself because everybody else is. Rude. They were rude to me. The fact that I stayed sober, all those rude people telling me shit I didn't want to hear, you know. And a lot of those people are gone today. A lot of those people have died. You know, a lot of our most of our old-timers here are gone. You know, I look around the room and it's like me and Luke and Billy. It's me and Luke. So now I get to be that crotchety old person that sits at the end of the table going, hey, be quiet over there. They're ringing your neck. Hey. I am so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what, if you're new, first I want to congratulate the birthday people. That's huge, you know, and to Kat. If you're new and you think, wow, what a bunch of lames. Yeah, that's what I thought too. You know, come on in, join us, be a lame. Yeah, you and everybody else in this room, dude. So, yeah, welcome. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Hang out. Give yourself a break, work all the steps, and if you still don't like what you get, then you can go back out there. All them people that are out there doing that same thing will be doing that same thing, hitting the pipe or sitting on the bar stool talking the same shit when you get done with those steps. You won't have missed a thing. It'll be like Groundhog Day all over again. They will be doing the same shit they were doing when you walked away. So, I don't know. You know what? I'm really grateful to be here, and I'm a product of everybody that has helped me in my recovery. You know, none of this is original. None of this is new. the fact that I stand up here isn't about me. It's about all the women and men that have helped me in recovery over the last 25 years. So if you're new, keep coming back. You know what? It gets weird, and then it gets better. You know? You just got to stay past the weird to get the better. You know? So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Suzanne. Another hand for Suzanne, please.